Good afternoon, everyone. So I think we'll get started. My name is Stacy Rasgon. I'm Bernstein's senior analyst covering the U.S. semiconductor space. I can't express what an honor it is to have our guests, plural, here today. Gary Dickerson, the President and CEO, and Dan Durn, the CFO of Applied Materials. So the semiconductor capital equipment industry has been enjoying a bit of a renaissance over the last several years. I think the much-anticipated kind of end of Moore's Law, far from reducing the need for customers to spend on equipment, looks like it's been the opposite. It's made contributions from companies like Applied Materials more important than ever as materials-driven innovation moves to the forefront of process technology development. And in conjunction with hopefully a reduced cyclical environment in semis overall, I think there's a hope that semicap is no longer the tip of the bullwhip that it might have been in cycles past. Now, while we don't cover Applied Materials, I think it's fair to say the company still comes up very frequently in my conversations with investors. And right now, I'd say many of those questions center on the right trajectory for WFE spending into next year and beyond, how to get confidence that the current strength that we've been seeing in the industry is truly secular rather than cyclical, whether the industry could actually be poised for a new renaissance of leading-edge growth with new applications like artificial intelligence and others, as well as what prospects are going forward for the company's progress in display. And to answer these and hopefully many other questions, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Gary and Dan. Hey, guys, thank you so much for being here today. By the way, you should have question cards at your seats. We will have a chance for question and answers at the end. You can fill those up. A Bernstein representative will collect them and bring them up here so I can ask them on stage. Hopefully I won't fall off here. Thanks. So thank you so much for being here today. I typically don't like to use this forum to address shorter-term issues, but it is the question I'm getting most often when I talk with clients. Let's just clear the air on it. Wafer fab equipment spending through this year and next year, you've given a number of about $100 billion-ish, and I think there's a perception from investors from your last call on what that might imply for next year. I just want to know if you have anything maybe there that you can or might be able to clarify on that point.
Yeah, so thanks, Stacy. I appreciate the opportunity.
And then we will get to the more interesting stuff, I promise.
So a few months ago, we started talking about a directional guide for 2018 and 2019. And I'll go into a little bit of the history as to why in a little bit. But what we are not intending to do is say 2018 plus 2019 is exactly $100 billion. That is not what we're doing. What we're not doing is saying if 2018 is $52 billion, for lack of a better number, that 2019 is $48 billion. That is not what we're saying. If I have to take the over under on $100 billion, I'm definitely taking the over. Do I think 2019 has a five handle on it? I do. And based on conversations we're having with customers, we're planning on 2019 being up on 2018. So I hope that level of specificity helps people. The reason we give a directional guide is our industry has a history, and it's a history that investors know very, very well. The industry historically has gotten to $35 billion in size, and each year afterwards, it's declined a little over 20% on average. It did it in 2000, it did it again in 2007, and it did it again in 2011. But in 2016, we also hit $35 billion. And the industry didn't decline. It actually increased and increased pretty healthily to above $48 billion. So we broke that cycle. Not only did it increase in 2017, but it's up again in 2018. And I gave an indication on what we think in 2019. And we give that directional guide to indicate that we're seeing things differently today than we have historically in this industry. When it was a PC-centric world and the demand was defined by the PC, you would go through three-year boom-bust cycles that were very dramatic in our industry. And then about 2010, you layered in significant demand from the handset and went to an annual refresh cycle in addition to the PC upgrade cycle. And that structurally made our industry larger and lowered volatility. and we see further diversification of that end market demand and consolidation of our customer base, leading to more disciplined and rational behavior than we've seen in the past. And so when we take a step back, the directional guide is intended to say that we're experiencing a nice level of activity today. It was a good level of activity in 2017, and fundamentals into 2019 are good based on that context. So hopefully that helps clarify the issue for people.
That's very helpful. Let's follow up on that. So, you know, we used to have an industry that used to be sitting, you know, used to peak, like you said, $30-$35 billion. Now we're looking at, you know, ideally $50 billion plus. It doesn't sound like it's necessarily the same sort of peak behavior that we used to see. It sounds like it could be sustainable. Could you go maybe a little more into your views of some of those drivers, or whether it's in increasing capital intensity, more materials dependent node migration, 3D memory, new applications driving leading-edge demand, the lack of wafer size improvements or increases. I guess, how would you guys maybe rank order some of those drivers? What do you think are the biggest drivers, and how do investors, I guess, get comfortable at this point that this is actually not necessarily a peak behavior, but even maybe like a new normal, like this is the new level that maybe we build off going forward as the industry grows?
Yeah. So when we take a step back from the markets we're involved in, and we look at some of the thematic trends that are occurring right now, the data economy, artificial intelligence, autonomous driving, Internet of Things, we think those trends are real. And on the critical path of those trends are semiconductors, and on the critical path of semiconductors is the capital equipment industry. And we're seeing strength across all device types. We see strength in logic, in foundry, in NAND, and DRAM. And we see multiple years of strength in each of those device types. So that is encouraging to us. The leg up in terms of the size, aggregate size of our industry isn't being driven by a single vector. It's strength across all device types. We go back to 2000.
Do you think that's different than in the past, by the way? You sort of talked about PCs and smartphones, and I think there's more diversification now.
I think I think if you go back to 2007, when we had a big correction in the industry, the largest driver at that time was DRAM, and it's larger than it is today, at an industry that was structurally smaller than it is today. So I think we do see more diversification. And we see it across device types, but even within things like foundry, you see diversification between leading edge and trailing node investments. You go back a decade, 90% of the investments were on the leading edge. Then it evolved to 80/20, then 60/40, and today we see it as about balanced 50/50 between leading edge and trailing edge, and we saw the same dynamic last year. So not only amongst device types do we see strength and diversity, but within device types we're seeing a good dynamic. You go back to 2000 when 300 millimeter wafers cut in, WFE divided by industry revenue peaked at 17%. Then you get a whole host of efficiency gains from that wafer size transition, along with factory automation systems, a philosophy on how to run factories and drive yield and output. And by 2013, WFE divided by industry revenue bottomed at about 9%. And since then, it's climbed back up to 12%. We talk about complexity increasing. There's reasons to believe that'll increase over time. But even if you hold it flat, and you think about semiconductors on the critical path of these major macro trends, hard to argue that the semi industry won't be materially higher in 2025 than it is today, and then take a point of view on our industry as a ratio of that revenue to get the manufacturing capacity in place to drive that growth and that aggregate level of revenue, our industry has to benefit. And so we think our industry could be materially higher in 2025 than it is today.
Let me push back on that growth point for a minute, at least on the industry. So semis as a whole, actually for most of my career on Wall Street, frankly, I mean, once we stabilized in 2010 after the downturn, ex memory, the industry has been roughly flattish, plus or minus, until last year, by the way, where the industry grew 22%. X memory grew 10, and I think we hit $400 billion, over $400 billion for the first time in history. So I guess what you're suggesting is that sort of flattish plus or minus X memory that was the anomaly. Are you making the argument now that you do think semis, again, whether it's new applications or anything else, do you think semis as a whole are on a growth trajectory going forward?
I do think they're on a growth trajectory. Again, hard to enable those trends, and we're not talking consumer discretionary investments. We're talking about investments by the largest corporations in the largest industries that strike right at the heart of their competitiveness. And so their ability to monetize those investments, their ability to compete with those investments, creates a whole new case around making those investments. And then you see proliferation of edge devices as well as high-performance compute in the cloud. And that diversification is driving an increased level of activity across all device types. So we see diversification, and we see strength going forward in support of those trends.
Got it. What are your thoughts, I guess, on those growth drivers as they pertain to, like, logic and foundry versus memory?
So here's the interesting thing. We talked about diversification between leading edge and trailing node. If you were to talk to us a couple years ago, we would have said 28 nanometers and sort of the 32, 22 SOI bookends of 28 would have peaked at about 330,000 wafer starts a month. Then we raised it to 360, then 400, then 420, and now we're at 500. So you can see increased consumption at that trailing node geometry. We think 10, 7, 5 as a collective node.
Okay. Is that how you define leading edge at this point?
10, 7,
Okay.
5 is leading edge. Everything else is trailing node. We see that peaking at 400,000 wafer starts a month. And so you can see between those two, you probably have over half of the wafer starts per month in the industry accounted for over the next handful of years. And so we really do see diversification of that spend across an entire node profile.
What do you think the likelihood is that the capital intensity of the industry continues to increase? So you said it gone, you know, from 17, troughed at 9, crawled back up to 12. But again, some of the other things, again, like wafer size transitions, probably, maybe you have a different point of view, by the way, but at this point, it doesn't look like they're happening anytime soon. Is there any sort of, you know, relief valve in the industry to reduce that capital intensity, or would it be a conservative assumption just to assume that it actually stays flat at 12 going forward?
I think it's a reasonable assumption to keep it flat. There will always be things like new architectures or new structures over time that potentially influence that number. It can't grow into perpetuity, and so it's gonna level out at some point. That represents the technical complexity embedded in bringing more advanced devices to market that companies can afford the economics of doing it because they can monetize it. You know, data centers used to be necessary for a company to compete. Today, they're profit centers for very large companies, and their ability to monetize those investments goes up dramatically.
Okay. Maybe a question for Gary. So I guess if I'm looking out over 5 years, and I mean, you've talked a lot about a lot of these types of applications.
Sure.
Where do you see, like, kind of the biggest driver of WFE growth and wafer demand? Maybe among applications that may be less present today, but in terms of, like, the growth, like, where do you see it actually coming from? What are you most excited about in terms of what you see?
Well, I would say I've never been more excited about our markets and also our position in the markets. So, you know, you guys have been talking about mobility, you know, the war for mobility leadership, the annual war during the Christmas season, Chinese New Year. And, you know, everybody in the audience here, they have a computer and a ability to take pictures, a camera in their pocket, right? So, you know, that's way more pervasive than anything we've seen in the past. You know, when you were back where the industry was driven by a PC on your desktop and waiting for the operating system, you have tremendously pervasive demand for semiconductors. And then you go to the future for AI and big data. And, you know, I'm a deep believer. We're connected into the ecosystem. There's tremendous investments that are taking place in disrupting transportation, healthcare, retail, entertainment, all of these different industries. And, you know, people talk about trillions of dollars of economic value where technology is reshaping these major industries. So you look at what that means for us. It's data generation. Dan talked already, and if you look at foundry and logic today, 50% of the business is on trailing edge. So you see growth in sensors, IoT-type devices, all of those types of things. And we think that growth is going to continue going forward. Then you're storing more data. And if you go into a data center and you open the rack and you look at a solid-state drive versus a hard drive inside that rack, power consumption is completely different. The heat generation is different. But again, the data generation is significant. And what we showed last year at our investor meeting is that the memory shipments are tracking that increased data generation. And then, you know, people talk about the Industrial Revolution and oil powering the Industrial Revolution. But oil sitting in a barrel isn't worth much. You've got to process it to create value. The same thing's true with data. So high-performance computing, you see AI chips that are as big as they can possibly build them with 100 billion V is a tremendous amount of complexity. And then connecting all that together with 5G. So for us, I mean, certainly everyone will continue to have computers in their pockets. The images they capture, the memories they capture with those cameras are going to be increasing in resolution and richer in data content. But the really big inflection that we see, and already we see some of this in our business, is AI and big data, transforming major industries, creating trillions of dollars of economic value.
You're doing an AI day in July, I just saw you.
We are. We're doing an AI forum. We'll have some AI companies, a number of different participants in that event.
I guess, what capabilities do you think AMAT actually brings to the table specifically around applications like AI, technological or otherwise?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we're kind of at a perfect storm relative to, for a few things. One is, I personally have never had more fun than I'm having today relative to the opportunities that we have in our markets. I really deeply believe that the war for AI leadership is the biggest battle of our lifetime. Mobility certainly was a meaningful driver of our business, but this war for AI leadership is going to be significant. And I think at the same time, technology roadmaps, you talked about capital intensity, the technology roadmaps are being challenged. Moore's Law is being challenged. So when you look at, again, tremendous economic value, but the pace of technology innovation is very difficult. When you're scaling the memory devices, memory went from scaling in two dimensions to scaling in a third dimension because you ran out of electrons, you had physical limitations, cost limitations, and it's all about materials innovation in the vertical direction. Logic is moving in that same way. And if you look at Applied's vision is to create, make possible the technology that shapes the future. It's all about materials innovation. We're using more elements on the periodic table than we ever have in the past. And when you look about...
I won't ask how many.
Well, even if you take one material like silicon nitride, there are like 10 versions of silicon nitride with different compositions. So we're using more elements. The ability to scale devices is harder and harder. And it's about creating materials, modifying materials, removing materials, analyzing materials, and really integrated material systems where Applied has a broader portfolio of technologies in creating and modifying and removing those materials than any company on the planet. And I think the playbooks that worked in the past will not work going forward. We already see evidence that they're not working. That happened in memory. You had the biggest change that you'd had in decades going from 2D to 3D types of technologies. You're seeing logic processes being integrated into the DRAM, high-speed DRAM types of devices. And you see logic going more vertical with FinFETs, taller fins, contacts over the gate. And, you know, when I talk to investors, one thing I ask investors is, what do you think it's worth to have the winning AI chip 12 months earlier? And the answers I get normally are between $20 and $100 billion. And it's all about creating new structures. Solving the major industry challenges are absolutely enabled by materials innovation, whether it's power, performance, even pattern placement, you know, aligning all of these layers one to the next. you know, the shorter wavelength doesn't align those features better.
Do you have a good way, I guess, for the generalists in the audience to sort of put into context, like, how difficult it actually is, like, what these features actually look like, how small they are? Is there a good, do you have a good way to think about that?
Well, they're certainly smaller than the human hair.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing I would say is that people always think, the playbook in the past, and I can't emphasize this enough, has run out of steam.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that in the speed of these technology nodes stretching out. So, you know, thinking along a two-dimensional scaling path, that didn't work in memory. It's not going to continue to work in logic. And more you're going to go with new structures, new materials, more elements on the periodic table, and you're going to integrate those together in a single platform. You know, when you have these materials that you're creating, if you move from one platform to the next, you can grow an oxide, you can corrode the metal. So this integrated material system with the portfolio we have within Applied is absolutely unique versus any company on the planet. And again, the pull that we have from customers around these new technologies is stronger and broader than we've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Got it. One thing I would say for those of you that aren't as familiar with this, to put it into context, you know, Intel makes features that they call 14 nanometers. If I just take that number,
yes,
they're using a laser with a wavelength of 193 nanometers to print it. So they're printing features that are like 7% of the wavelength of light that they're using.
Yes.
I mean, I'm amazed this stuff works at all.
It's like magic.
It really shouldn't. And people complain, right? That chip costs $1.50. It's too much. It needs to be $1.25.
Like a hamburger.
Yeah. Is EUV good or bad for your business?
Well,
EUV is extreme ultraviolet, by the way, for those that...
So it's a shorter wavelength when you're printing patterns on a wafer. So first I would put EUV into context. If you look at half of the business's memory, where EUV really doesn't play much of a role. There's a lot of focus on materials innovation. You know, the sky's the limit in terms of vertical scaling, bringing logic take the technology into the DRAM. So that really EUV plays almost no role.
Mm-hmm.
Then if you go to foundry and logic, about half of it is the IoT sensor trailing geometries. And then you go to 25% of the spend is the leading edge logic.
Mm-hmm.
And EUV is being targeted for steps where you need smaller feature sizes. So you said you go to the shorter wavelength, you can print smaller feature sizes. Those steps are ones where we really have no share today. So the opportunity for us is also to grow as EUV is adopted. But the other thing I would say is that the even maybe bigger industry challenge is, how do I align those features one layer to the next as I'm building up the semiconductor device? And, you know, there's a blog that's out talking about a conference that happened in January with NVIDIA and Intel and others. And, you know, what they said in that conference was that, you know, a shorter wavelength gives you better resolution, but it doesn't necessarily place things better from one layer to the next. And so it's really materials innovation. It comes back to materials innovation. How I build those structures is really what is absolutely crucial. So when we look at our patterning business, we've grown about $1 billion in patterning over the last 4 years. As you go to multi-patterning in memory and in some of these other steps, and as you enable solutions to placing layers one to the next, we see another $1 billion in growth in our patterning business over the next 4 years.
Got it. And the areas you've talked about for growth are patterning, our services, our display.
Absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about each of those areas and what you see?
Yeah, sure. So, again, I just can't emphasize enough, the playbook has to change in the semiconductor industry, and whether it's memory or logic, it's about materials innovation. And if you think that AI big data is going to disrupt those industries, no matter how those architectures evolve, which they will absolutely evolve, we're at the foundation of all of that. So materials innovation in semi, memory, logic, great opportunity for us. Our services business over the last 2 quarters has grown 30% year on year. So as customers are ramping these new technologies, it's increasingly complex to get output, yield, the device performance uniformity. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing increasing demand for our service business. Also, China's ramping. There's
the services, by the way, that's maintenance and spares and that.
Maintenance, spares, and increasingly service agreements with customers. So what we do is we help them optimize yield, device performance, and output of those huge investments they're making in our equipment. And so that business, we've said will grow at about 15%. The target we had for 2020 was $4.5 billion, and that business is growing at a very healthy pace. The other thing that we did about 4 years ago was focus more on service agreements. So it's sticky, more sticky,
like recurring,
recurring business going forward. So on 300 millimeter with service agreements, we can get up to 10x average increase in terms of our service revenue when we have service agreements.
You mean like over the lifetime of the contract?
Yes, on an annual basis versus no contract. So what we had before in 13, we had net zero increase in service agreements. With a change in our strategy and the value that we provide for customers, now we're seeing over 1,000 increase in service agreements per year. And that's increasing our stickiness of that business. And it's, again, what we communicate is about a 15% compound annual growth rate going forward.
So how big is your installed base, I guess, in terms of tools, and how many of those are covered under service agreements at this point?
We don't give a specific number relative to the percent of the service agreements. The installed base is...
It's over 38,000 tools.
Okay.
And... you know, one of the great things about the services business is it's like buying an automobile. You know, initially your auto is on warranty, something mm-hmm. breaks, you take it into the shop,
yeah.
it gets taken care of. When it gets off of warranty, then it's on your dime to fix your auto.
Mm-hmm.
The same is true with our systems business. For the first year, they're on warranty, and it doesn't provide an uplift to our services
mm-hmm.
business. Once it comes off of warranty, it then starts providing that uplift, and we had record shipments in 17
mm-hmm.
and record shipments again in 18, so that'll be a nice tailwind for us.
So I know you don't give the number, but it's fair to say that there's a lot of headroom to sign new service agreements within that installed base.
There's a lot of headroom.
Yeah.
Would
you say
headroom.
That I guess the cumulative services revenue over the lifetime of the tool, how does that compare with the original price of the tool?
Larger.
Think it's bigger?
Yeah. Can be definitely.
Can be sometimes multiples of the tool price.
Yeah.
Got it. So you guys aren't the only ones that have been sounding very positive on semicap. Obviously, all of your competitors sound very positive on the state of semicap. You guys have talked about gaining share in a number of areas.
Yeah.
All of your competitors also believe they're gaining share. How do we reconcile? How do we reconcile that?
Well, I think if you look at our business, go back to 2013. We had an investor conference, and we talked about the conversion from 2D to 3D NAND.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at that point, it was somewhat controversial about the increase in capital intensity and the shift towards etch and deposition. At that time, we had forecasted would be significant.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at 2013, our share, if you go across all of the different device types, the only device type we had more than 15% of the spend was in foundry. Everything else was DRAM, NAND, logic, 15% or less. Today, all of those markets were 20% or higher. So again, as memory has went more towards materials intensity, our percentage of spending in DRAM and NAND, and as again, in logic, all of those areas are above 20%.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look over the last 6 years, we've grown faster than the market, and we anticipate that we'll do that again this year and next year. And I think the thing I would also, again, continue to emphasize, so we've had that growth over the last few years. We're the most balanced company in the industry. When you put logic processes into memory, we have great share there, and we have unique technologies with high market share going into to those areas. But I still, you know, deeply believe that going forward, what got us to this point is not going to get us to where we need to go.
Mm-hmm.
The technology roadmap, Moore's Law, is being challenged. And the new playbook around integrated material systems and platforms puts us in a fantastic position
mm-hmm.
to enable new structures that enable these mega inflections in the economy.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any point of view on maybe some of your specific advantages by process type, whether it's dep or etch or...
Well, if you look at creating materials, I don't want to get into specific. I mean, we can talk about epi and PVD and all of these things, but the main point on this is that we have 90% share in some types of materials where it is incredibly unique. And I go back to this meeting I had with, I meet with all of the people running R&D on a regular basis. A year ago, sitting down with one of the heads of R&D, he said, Gary, this material is a great material electrically, but we have difficulty integrating it, polishing it, removing it. And if you look at the breadth of technologies with PVD, epi, implant, anneal, e-beam technologies, we have by far the broadest portfolio of anybody in the industry. So when you look at creating structures that enable the winners in AI or new memory devices or all of those kinds of areas, we're in a completely unique position. And as you work in creating a material and then you have the next steps in the process on a single platform so you don't break vacuum and grow oxides or damage that surface, Applied is really the only company that has that portfolio breadth for an integrated materials platform that we can deliver. That will become really much more important going forward.
Is that really true, though? I mean, we have like Lam, and back when you could still do mergers in semicap, right? They bought Novellus. I mean, so it was an etch player with deposition, CNT, and bringing it together.
Yes.
And obviously, they were trying to assemble that same kind of portfolio.
Yes.
You think it's still true that you really believe you guys are the only ones with the sort of the true portfolio approach?
There's no question that we're unique in terms of technologies. I mean, you can have unit processes, and you know, from Applied, we've also really focused on changing our company strategy around speed. You know, if I can get that AI chip to market 12 months faster, it's worth $100 billion. So we've aligned around speed and connectivity. So I think the most limiting factor for any company is how you define yourself. And I think, you know, Applied, we really focused a lot on unit process steps. We're technologists. We love solving tough technical challenges. But I think really understanding, and we brought in different capabilities in the company to understand those structures, and we've really restructured so that now the connectivity through Applied is stronger than it's ever been. And there is no question, if you look at the breadth of technologies versus anyone in the industry, Applied is broader in creating unique materials. If you look at modifying materials, the example I gave in planarizing, polishing, we have extremely high share there in that technology. And there's many examples. Implants, another one. So combining those technologies together in a single platform or working with customers so that not in serial fashion, going from one step to another step, being able to work those problems in parallel at a higher speed is absolutely crucial to the future. So when we talk about this AI forum that we're going to have at Semicon West, where you have some AI companies, current and new AI companies, it's all about structure. We gave an example last year in the investor meeting in automotive. And what we said is a 1% adoption of autonomous vehicles drives 25 times more memory than the world can produce today. So...
wait a minute. So does that mean that it drives tons of demand, or does that mean we're never going to see autonomous vehicles?
Well, that's a good question. So the answer is you have to innovate. You have to have architectural innovation. Uh-huh. And that's going to happen. There's no question that that's going to happen. So again, I think we're right at the foundation of enabling those architectural innovations. So what you see in the market today from an architecture standpoint is not going to be what's going to win 5 years from now. I deeply believe that. You're going to need innovation, and it's all about, again, these integrated material systems, I believe, is the number one enabling technology.
So if you can deliver that, and you're enabling customers to get to market like 12 months faster with like highly critical parts, how do you price? Are you actually like, I mean, there's obviously there's cost plus, there's also value pricing, right?
Yeah.
How do you guys think about just more generally around pricing strategy if you can actually deliver these capabilities that nobody else can? Like, how does that come into it?
Yeah, I think that the number one thing for us is engaging in the ecosystem. So one of the things that we've also focused on over the last 18 months is a better connectivity through the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So I think before, having these capabilities, and there's degrees of separation mm-hmm. between what we do and what the systems companies do. So being able to better understand what matters to them and how can we enable structures that are disruptive. I mean, our goal is to do that across the whole ecosystem and all the partners that we can work with to accelerate these mega inflections for the industry. You know, how that all plays out and what those relationships will look like. What I would say today, what that means is that we are in deeper and earlier collaborations with our customers than we've ever been in the past. Mm-hmm. And when you look at our technology center, we have customers living there full time, Maiden Technology Center in Santa Clara, living there full time, working with us on these advanced structures. And it's both current and new customers that are there's more money going into innovation in new structures that enable these mega inflections. So that collaboration is earlier and deeper than ever throughout the whole ecosystem.
Do you feel comfortable talking about like where new R&D dollars are going at this point, or do you have to be surprised? Like, and maybe like a gentler version, like how far in advance of like these new innovations are you actually pulling the trigger on the investment?
Well, I think that, so if you look at what, since I've come to the company a little over 5 years ago, you know, the first thing we did was rebalance R&D and G&A. So I think the first year we cut G&A something like 30%. And, you know, we're very focused. I think you have to have a point of view and courage. That's the number one thing. We have a point of view, and we definitely have courage. So, but we're also disciplined in terms of, you know, how we look at overall investment throughout the company. So R&D went from about, and G&A were about even to it's two-thirds R&D, one-third G&A. That's one thing we did. And we, through portfolio management and rebalancing, we generated a huge amount of firepower within, you know, a certain OPEX mm-hmm. profile. Going forward, I really deeply believe whether it's semiconductor, silicon that's enabling AI and big data, AR, VR, engineered optics, or even new markets. Mm-hmm. I, you know, there are tremendous opportunities in creating materials, enabling structures that people don't even know are possible today. Again, our vision, make possible the technology that shapes the future. Uh-huh. So the engagements we have through the ecosystem are earlier and deeper, and even in new markets, we are engaged with very big companies in other markets mm-hmm. where we're focused on enabling disruptions through the technologies we have. Mm-hmm. So again, specifically, I don't want to get into those details, but it's really, again, it's around enabling these new structures.
Mm-hmm. What do you think China's aspirations mean for you?
Well, we have a very...
That's an open-ended question.
Sure, sure. So China, we have a very high share in mm-hmm. semiconductor and display. We've been in China for more than 30 years. So our share in semiconductor and display is the highest of any company. Mm-hmm. China has...
Individually or combined?
Both. Our share in both semi and display is very large. I'm also on the U.S.-China Business Council. I'll be in Washington next week.
They could use you.
We have, so, you know, well, basically, if you look at China in 2018 for Applied, it's pretty much balanced between, in semiconductor, between global and domestic mm-hmm. companies. And if you look at the domestic companies, it's actually more weighted towards trailing foundry logic. Mm-hmm. So think IoT, sensors, those kinds of devices, mm-hmm. which, as Dan talked about, that's growing at a very fast pace. Then you have also investment, less, but you have investment in pilot capability and memory technologies. So, and then the global companies are more weighted towards memory. So you have Xi'an for Samsung, Wuxi for Hynix, Dalian for Intel. And China is a growing opportunity. We look at leading indicators for especially the domestic investments. Mm-hmm. Do they have technology? Do they have money? We actually sell the factory automation system, so we have pretty good visibility into the spending. And then we look at all those leading indicators and we come up with most likely scenario and upside scenario. And there's a big difference between those two. But, you know, what I would say is we see increased spending in China. We don't actually see a hockey stick.
Okay.
Semiconductor is not like solar. People look at solar where you have 10 steps. It's very simple. It's a completely different technology. If you go to Xi'an, you have a small Korean city there. You have hundreds of engineers that are living there. The same thing is happening in these other cities where, you know, the talent necessary to ramp those complex processes and the technology, it's really hard. So it will be many years before you have competitive technologies. So will there be investment?
Define many.
I would say 7 to 10, okay. Many years. You'll have investment, and there certainly is a strategy to grow that industry. But if you look at the efficiency, bits produced per dollar invested, it's not going to be very efficient for a very long time. You know, I think one analogy, if you go back to Korea and Japan. So at one time, Japan was dominant in memory. It took a long time for Korea to build that industry to be competitive. So if you look at hundreds of engineers that have experience around, you know, the best-known methods and technology, and then the technology and the IP necessary to build those devices, I think that it's pretty clear that building leading-edge NAND, 3D NAND, is not so easy. And also the same thing is true with DRAM.
Haven't the statements coming out of China been a bit more aggressive than that?
They may have been.
Uh-huh. You don't believe them?
I'll stick by what I said.
Okay.
I'm not saying I don't believe them, but I believe in what I told you.
Okay. I wanted to give you a reminder, by the way, if you have question cards, if you have things that you would like me to ask, you can fill those out and they can start bringing them up to the front. I want to talk about display a little bit. So I guess in the near term, you are looking for it to decline next year. Can you talk a little bit about the strength this year? Number one, number two, I guess, kind of what's leading the bit of a pause next year, and then kind of like longer term, how you see that business.
So display is a business we're excited about. It's a great business. 2012 to 2017 grew at an average compound rate of 25% mm-hmm. per year. It's up again 30% into 18. We are seeing a sequential decline into 19, as Gary said on the call, 15-20% down. In 2020, we see a recovery to a level north of where we were in 2018. And when you unpack that by device type, there's large format TVs and then there's the mobile handset. Mm-hmm. And we still see strength in the TV market, and those plans are moving forward, 13 Gen 10.5 factories between now and 2021. And the way to think about a Gen 10.5 factory is similar to a wafer size transition in the semiconductor industry. You go from 200 to 300 millimeters, you get 2.25 times the number of chips on a single wafer. In a Gen 10.5 factory, you get 8 65-inch TVs per substrate, so they're the size of
on
a garage door
glass.
On one piece of glass, versus an 8.5 factory where you had 3.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a little over 2.5 times the same number of displays per substrate. So that market is holding together well. Where we saw a bit of the hiccup that led to reprofiling 19 and 2020 is weakness in the high-end smartphone market. The product cycle led to excess capacity or excess...
is this LCD or OLED, by the way, or is it both?
OLED.
OLED.
Excess components in the supply chain, that's now been worked through. Implication is Samsung's A5 factory is going to be delayed. It's not going to go into volume manufacturing in 2019, and that's caused a push reprofiling of the revenue.
Okay.
The 23 factories to support that industry, instead of being built by 2021, we see them built by 2023. And at the core of it is the rate of adoption in the handset of an OLED screen. Now, our confidence in OLED as the preferred technology long-term in the handset is unchanged. It's got higher pixel density, better refresh rates, lower power consumption, and it allows enablement of a roadmap to get interesting form factors like curved displays mm-hmm. and foldable displays that you can't get in an LCD format. And at high volume manufacturing, has a better cost entitlement than an LCD. Mm-hmm. So you get the technical advantages and a better cost entitlement. Right now, supply in the industry is limited.
You said in high volume. Is the initial outlay more than LCD, but the running cost is less, or how do the economics there work?
Well, certainly the capital intensity for us is better.
Yeah,
that's what
the opportunity
yeah.
for us is better.
Yeah,
I'd have to check on overall factory cost.
But you benefit from OLED versus LCD.
We benefit significantly
for sure.
from OLED.
That's what I thought.
And lost my train of thought.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Well, I think OLED, you know, the I think, as Dan said, power, performance, form factor, cost, the entitlement's there.
Mm-hmm.
So right now you have one company that can produce. One company that can produce those screens. So, you know, in that kind of a market environment, you're not getting as close to the entitlement in terms of the pricing as you could. So, you know, there's some delay in terms of those companies, those other companies coming online. But, you know, our current view is 2020, our display business revenue will be higher than 2018. Again, we had 25% compound annual growth rate, 12 to 17, 30% 18, 19 down, 20 above 18.
What are you thinking about in terms of kind of like high-end smartphones in terms of the units? Are you thinking to get that kind of growth? Do those need to grow, or are you thinking those are flat? Or?
I don't think that models significant growth in high-end smartphones. Again, what we see is for sure there's an entitlement in the efficiency, the performance, the refresh rates, form factors, and cost. When you get to scale, there's an entitlement for lower cost. So, you know, and then, again, form factor, curved screens, all of those things we think will drive demand for that. And again, we're pretty well connected through the ecosystem, so we have a pretty good understanding of what the roadmaps are for all of those different companies.
And when you get diversity of supply and competition, economic entitlement will be realized and proliferation mm-hmm. in the devices will occur.
I think it just takes a little longer now.
Takes a little bit longer.
Got it.
Okay. I wanted to ask about just industry cyclicality and like how that's actually been feeding into your use of cash. So semis as a whole have been less cyclical recently. I think there's a view. By the way, I don't sign up for the no cyclical argument, but I will sign up for less cyclical. Semicap historically has been kind of the second derivative, and maybe that's easing a little bit, so you're less cyclical now. The industry as a whole now, I mean, generates cash, where it historically it didn't necessarily do that. How are you guys thinking now about investments and use of cash? I do want to get, because it does seem to be a different part of the story than maybe we saw a few years ago.
Yeah, so the great thing is the company's been performing extremely well. Not only the organic growth that Gary and the team have driven in the company over the last handful of years, mm-hmm. but if you take a look at the discipline and the way in we've been investing, and Gary talked about it, in 2013, OpEx to sales was 28.3%. Mm-hmm. In 17, it was 18.3%, so a 10-point improvement in those 4 years, and you'll see it come down again this year. Mm-hmm. So the discipline with which investments are being made to drive that growth is yielding a financial profile that's dramatically different today mm-hmm. than when Gary walked into the company. So the company's exposed to better markets, our performance is better, and we generate a lot of cash. At our analyst day, and we've been pretty consistent about this over time in terms of priorities for use of cash, grow the company, maintain a healthy and flexible balance sheet, and then return cash to shareholders. If you look at the last 20 years, the last two decades, on average, 90% of free cash flow has gone back to shareholders, predominantly in the form of share repurchase, but we've recently doubled our dividend. And I think it makes, when we take that whole package of capital allocation together, it makes a strong statement on where we think our end markets are going, how we think our respective execution against that opportunity is going to be, and the sustainability of the cash flow that we're generating today out into the future. And then two things I would say is we made a very large share repurchase last quarter, and over the last four quarters, we've repurchased close to 10% of the company. And then from a dividend standpoint, as we grow the company, and again, the industry and the company matures further, as we grow the company, we'll look for opportunities to continue to increase that over time. But keeping true to the principle of the vast majority of cash will get returned to shareholders over the long run.
Got it. Should we go to the lightning round?
Let's go.
Here's a good one. How will you know when the next downturn is coming?
Well, we don't certainly, we don't see that, you know, Dan talked about the view on 2019. Again, you know, at least from what we see today in terms of the drivers and data generation, data storage, connectivity with 5G's coming, you know, all of those things, we just, I don't see. I think certainly we can't anticipate macro events, right?
Sure.
If you have some kind of a geopolitical event that causes a significant downturn. And I, you know, I don't think the economy goes straight up forever, ever. So, you know, though, that certainly would be something that that could impact our business.
The other thing I'd point to.
But everybody.
Right.
It'll impact everybody, not just.
It'll impact everybody, absolutely. Absolutely.
The other thing I'd point to is I agree with you. There probably will be some cyclicality. I do think it's gonna be different than we've seen historically, and it gets back to what Gary said. Have a point of view.
Yeah.
And have conviction.
Yeah.
Do we think the semiconductor industry as a whole is gonna be structurally larger in 2025? I do. I think semiconductors are on the critical path of enabling those trends. To get that aggregate manufacturing capacity in place, our industry, Applied Materials will benefit from a structurally larger semiconductor capital equipment industry. We may have variations along the trend line. The important thing is where is the trend going? And that's something that we've got a lot of strength and conviction in.
I think the other thing, just from Applied Materials standpoint, we certainly think we're in a great position to enable these mega inflections. But the other thing is our service business is getting to be a much larger.
Yeah.
More meaningful part of the company, and, you know, the growth rate there is pretty significant. So even in the case where you have the display down in 2019, the service business is larger. Than display and growing at more than a rate to offset. That. So that breadth of our company is an advantage relative to volatility.
Got it. I have a question here on 3D NAND. 3D NAND transition's driven a lot of growth. What happens to NAND spending, when that transition is done?
So the NAND market, like most things in semiconductors, is a technology-driven market. There's been a couple contributors. The technology roadmap is gonna always evolve. And then you've got to transition from planar 2D technology to more vertical structures, 3D. In 2017, we were about 1.5 million wafer starts per month, half planar, half 3D. We'll exit 2018 maybe 1.6 million wafer starts per month. So additional capacity adds, two-thirds vertical, one-third planar. But growth, even if the industry becomes all vertical, adding more layers, stacking layers, scaling horizontally, scaling vertically, there's multiple dimensions to that roadmap. And when you put 32 capacity in place to do 32 layers, you get a certain bit output. When you make that same investment, same exact investment to go from 32 to 64 layers, you get 2x. Not quite, but you get 2x. When you put the next investment to go from 64 to 96 layers.
Yeah.
You get 1.5. And then you go to another 32 layers, and you get 1.3. So driving bit growth in a vertical world based on how those structures operate is by definition more capital intensive. So whether we're transitioning from planar to 3D or driving growth in purely 3D world, the roadmaps are constantly evolving. Capital intensity is increasing, and it's more expensive to drive 1% of growth, incremental growth on a go-forward basis. So we're really encouraged by what we see in that market.
Got it. So I have two more questions. We're almost out of time. The first question we're asking of every management team here, so I'd ask you to be specific. As you look 5 years into the future, what's the single biggest disruptive force that could be a threat to your business, and why?
I would go back to what I said earlier. The biggest limiting factor for any company is how you define yourself. I think our markets are better than ever, and our position in the markets are better than ever. But the question is really, do we reach our potential? I think AI and big data is the biggest battle that we've ever seen in our lifetimes. The economic value creation opportunity is tremendous. I also think it comes at the same time as a perfect storm of harder to develop those new technologies, harder to develop those new structures. So for us, we have to continue to implement changes inside Applied Materials to redefine who we are. It gets back to how do we enable, make possible technology that shapes the future? How do we connect together those integrated material systems? How do we drive, accelerate innovation that enables $100 billion of economic value, with these new device structures? I think that's the biggest challenge for us. For me, I can see tremendous opportunity for our company, but I don't think we're going to get where we need to go doing what we've done in the past. I don't think the playbooks in the past are going to optimize who we are 5 years from now.
Got it.
So it's really implementing that effectively and fast enough to capture the opportunity.
Got it. So we're almost out of time. I'm going to give you your 30-second soapbox to sum up. Why should investors buy your stock?
End markets are better than they've ever been. It's being driven by structural investments by the largest companies in the largest industries, not consumer discretionary. As we look at Moore's Law slowing down, increasingly power, performance, area, cost, the technical specifications of Moore's Law are going to be increasingly implemented through materials-based solutions. So we're the right company at the right time to solve increasingly complex challenges when demand for power and performance are better than they've ever been as a result of these macro trends. So structural improvement in our end markets, the right company at the right time to solve the industry's most complex problems, and we got the best CEO in the industry.
Ah, fantastic. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Stacy.